If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chollett. Thanks to Luke for sitting in yesterday. I was off on a secret mission, which we'll find out about next week. Just to keep you teased. Hello today to Adam, who listens to the podcast while doing the washing up. Yesterday the dishes were done a bit quicker than 5 minutes of the window, watching a couple of grebes on the canal. I live in Amsterdam. Strange birds, grebes. Coots are sociopaths. Absolute thugs. That's a thank you for that, Adam. Do let me know where you listen to the podcast. You can email me, matt.chollett@times.radio. You can also get in touch if you want to play the quiz on the radio show as well. Can you get to number 10? It's basically 10 general knowledge questions. That's all you've got to do. Get all 10 right and you'll become our show's Prime Minister. matt.chollett@times.radio if you want to do the quiz as well. Right, coming up on the podcast today, 20 years ago, a guy called Jimmy set up a thing called Wikipedia. You may have heard of it. I've been speaking to him to find out how the site has changed in the last 20 years, what he's got out of it, why he's about the only tech founder who isn't now a multi-billionaire and putting things into space, and the role of Wikipedia when we're trying to tackle fake news online and all of that. So that's coming up in the podcast shortly. But first, as ever, our columnist panel, and on a Tuesday, it's Finkovich. That's Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelvich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Oh, it's so silly, that! Oh, dear. Anyway, good morning, Danny.
Good morning. I'm going to have that played when I come down to breakfast.
The only because, as we know, you and David...
will then expect David to come as well.
Exactly. But... you and David live together, like sort of Morecambe and Wise, don't you? So that would be fine.
Yeah, like the Beatles in Help.
Yeah. Morning, David, as well. How are you?
Good morning.
Oh, I'm glad I dug that out. We had that made ages ago, and we thought it was too silly to use. But actually, it is so silly, I think we might now use that on a weekly basis. Good. Well, it's nice to have you with us. Nice to have you with us. So let's talk DIY disasters, if you like. Number 10's renovations and leaks and all that. And Danny, you've written a piece in the Times today where you think that the renovation, who paid for the flat renovations, might well be Boris Johnson's biggest headache.
Well, it's not the renovations. It's who paid for them.
Yeah.
So one of the problems with this political scandal is there's nothing he can do about it going forward because it's all behind him. So it's all based on what did he do and he can't undo what he's done. Well, it may be that people don't mind that the Prime Minister received money from a donor funneled through the Conservative Party to pay for his personal living expenses. And, you know, judging by quite a lot of the comments underneath my column in the paper this morning, the news analysis piece I wrote overnight, maybe it's people don't mind. But I think I've said this before on Redbox, on your show and then been on Redbox, people won't mind until they do, right? And this may not be the one that they mind about. But if you continually do things like this, you're lax about the rules, you think they don't apply to you, well, one day the rule that prime ministers aren't caught by these things won't apply to you either.
David, which of these various strands of awfulness coming out of Number 10 vexes you most?
Before we start, I have to say, that kind of yapping I can hear behind Danny, is that Cerberus?
It is the two-headed dog of news.
That's right. Because if so, he's rather underwhelming, if you ask me. I'm sure incredible.
She'd love to be Cerberus.
Like Danny, one of the things that I'm very interested in about all this is how people split into saying, and this is people of all kinds of political persuasions, it doesn't make any difference no matter what it is, because it's a kind of variant of it's not what people are talking about on the doorstep and so on. And I agree with Danny that it doesn't matter until it matters, and then it could matter quite a lot. So there are reasons why we have things like having to declare an interest. So some of the logic of people who says it doesn't matter would literally be it doesn't matter if MPs declare interests or not. Well, that's a recipe for a very bad time, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, and that's the reason why we do have those rules. So if indeed it is the case that actually he's trying to get away without declaring a rather substantial interest or payment or so on, or there is a kind of other interest there, that will and could matter. And Danny's also right, which is these things are kind of cumulative. The Conservative Party's been in power for a very long time now. And I don't really think it would take a kind of, you know, a massive change for Labour to be more competitive. There are all kinds of electoral problems with that, not least the situation in Scotland and so on. But it's not inconceivable that the Conservatives could be in a position of losing their majority. And at that point, these kind of perceptions could easily matter in certain places at certain times. But then there's the other point, which is some of these things actually just do matter. And they should matter to us, whether or not they matter electorally or not. This question about whether or not the electorate's going to take any notice can become a bully point if you're not very careful. And it means that you're kind of gradually taken away from questions of behaviour and morality and ethics. And that's a kind of bad situation for all of us if that happens.
I suppose the thing is that the whole point is it doesn't matter if no one in the country is following the ins and outs of Westminster. But if a minister was seen to have taken some money which influenced the decision, and we found that out because it was declared, then it should be out of the public, and that minister should resign. Part of the problem is it's the last bit of that equation. If the Prime Minister doesn't sack his Home Secretary when found to have broken the ministerial code, if he doesn't, you know, if he keeps his Housing Secretary, even, you know, when he seems to have signed off a deal for a property developer who'd given money to the Tory party, if everyone involved in the game isn't signed up to the accepted rules of the game, then what's the point? You know, it feels like
it's interesting that you. And we've got to revisit the whole question of who makes the judgment on the ministerial codes, because people are marking their own homework. And the other thing we've got to revisit on the ministerial code, by the way, is the presumption that if you break the ministerial code in any respect, you have to resign, because it produces an expectation that there won't be met, and leads you into the absurd situation where the ministerial code is quite plainly broken and the government ends up pretending that it hasn't been, which is exactly what happened in the Priti Patel case. It should be possible. Indeed, it should have also been possible in the Dominic Cummings case for people in politics to say, I think this was wrong. I apologise. I won't let it happen again. But I'm not going to resign, right? And I don't expect this person to resign. And then if it does happen again, obviously the situation changes. So I've been worried about various aspects of the management of the ministerial code, and this is one of them.
Yeah.
And my dog.
And Cerberus agrees. Cerberus agrees there. Cerberus agrees a lot. It was one of the kind of interesting things about the Nicola Sturgeon thing, that Scottish Tories, with support of Tories back in the rest of the United Kingdom, were incredibly adamant that Nicola Sturgeon would have to resign if she was found to have broken the ministerial code, if the Hamilton inquiry had declared that she had broken the ministerial code. But as soon as it comes to the UK, doesn't seem to give a tinker's toss about the ministerial code. Now, I'm not saying that I think that people in Stoke Poges or Red Wall seats have noticed that contradiction. But that contradiction undoubtedly takes away from the authority of, say, their denunciation of Nicola Sturgeon. It renders it actually to have no moral worth at all.
Yeah, maybe in that case we should. There's a sort of responsibility on the part of journalists to sort of not report those things, or to not give credibility to those things. I mean, part of my thought, and actually yesterday I was travelling quite a lot yesterday, so I did listen to quite a lot of coverage of this whole route. And I think part of the problem, particularly on the leaks side, is that you've got. But did Boris Johnson say he was happy? He'd rather see bodies piled up in the streets than have a third lockdown. Well, the point is, we didn't see bodies piled up in the streets, and we did have a third lockdown. It's a bit like David Cameron in his lobby, because David Cameron didn't end up with £200 million from Greens. You know, the lobbying story fought. David Cameron did lots of lobbying, but the ultimate upshot was he got nothing out of it. Boris Johnson said something. It appears that lots have suggested that Boris Johnson said something incredibly crass and insensitive, but it didn't happen. And he did end up having a third lockdown, and now the vaccination program's going very well, and that's the only thing that people really give two hoots about, rather than something he may or may not shouted through the door of an office 3 or 4 months ago.
Well, had he been recorded, I agree with you. Would that have made a difference? Sorry, Danny, go on.
Well, part of me thinks...
No, I strongly agree with that.
The Prime Minister should be able to shout things in his Downing Street office without people recording it, surely.
No. He's fortunate that this is where the focus is, because I'm sure that your view will be widely shared, right? If people... expect people to sort of say, you can say stupid, everyone says stupid things, right? And expostulate stupid things. And he has a particular way of saying things. I think most people will take that view. It's different, by the way, the view about whether they think he did the right things in those periods, whether he started the lockdown early enough. And I think there are serious public policy questions about that. But I doubt he'll pay a political price for that. My view is, the more that people are focused on, you know, Dominic Cummings said he said this, then he said he didn't say it, but it didn't happen. The less people are going to focus on an issue where I think he would probably be in more trouble if there was more focus on it. But one of the things that Boris Johnson's had politically has been quite a lot of luck.
Hell of a lot of luck. It is interesting, isn't it, how Gordon Brown got into an incredible amount of trouble for a thing he said about somebody, not indeed to her face, that bigoted woman, had to kind of apologise. Over-interpreters did what they always do, which was say this was the turning point of the entire century and so on. But nevertheless, it seemed to have a kind of significant effect, but only because you could hear him saying it. If Boris Johnson had been taped saying that, it would have been catastrophic. Absolutely, I have no doubt about that at all. It would have been catastrophic. It would be played and replayed and replayed. But because it's only reported speech, albeit with significant authority, it won't have the same level of effect. And there's something for us to kind of recall there when it comes to reporting or responding to these things, that actually it's quite often simply the luck of whether or not somebody has been taping you. If Dominic Cummings has actually, or did actually, tape Boris Johnson saying that, then in that case, I think that's a lot of trouble.
I'm still not sure, because the problem is there were two stories. There's the chatty rat who leaked the story of the lockdown in November, and there's the Boris Johnson saying he didn't want another lockdown. And so the problem with the two stories, they basically contradict each other. You've got, on the one hand, Boris Johnson saying something outrageous about not having a lockdown, and on the other hand, is about Boris Johnson having a lockdown. And so the whole thing just becomes, you know, the reality is Boris Johnson did or didn't say something stupid, but we did end up having a second lockdown, and we had a third lockdown, and there weren't bodies piled up in the street. So idiot says something
stupid.
Well,
actually, we had one late, and there were bodies that piled up, albeit not in the streets, and we all know that he was reluctant to have that lockdown. So I'm not totally sure it works in that way, and I'm not even sure that people would go through that process of thought. It would be enough if the voice was heard.
Yeah, maybe.
What we're establishing, Matt, here is that with all these scandals, you simply it's a fool's game to try and predict what the impact will be, because David's completely correct. It may change, you know, completely overnight if it turns out someone has a tape of these things, or it turns out that he said something irresponsible to someone else. You know, you just can't tell. What I think you can tell is that if you allow one after the other of these sorts of things to happen, you employ someone like Dominic Cummings in your government, you make these kind of very odd decisions about how to finance the decoration of your flat. One of these will end up causing you substantial difficulty. It's just very hard to predict which one of them it is in advance.
The dog certainly agrees with you. Honestly, we've had more messages about the dog than anything else this morning. Let's completely change the subject and talk about Aberdeen and the company, this Standard Life Aberdeen, which has decided to get rid of vowels as part of its rebrand. I mean, it'd be quite. The trouble is, you two have both got quite a lot of consonants in your name. So if we did get rid of vowels, it doesn't really help shrink it down particularly. Danny, do rebrands like this ever work? Daniel Finkelstein.
I mean, I honestly do. I sit on, I sit on boards, and I've been a customer through one of them of Aberdeen. And I mean, how are we supposed to pronounce that? You know, you're supposed to call up the person, the investment analyst, to tell us how our Aberdeen investments are going. It's just bizarre how they could have come up with that idea. It's one of the things in politics. If you ever end up discussing having a relaunch, you know that you're immediately in trouble. And we all remember what happened with Change UK. And there was always when the SDP continued, there was a whole when the Liberals, part of it split and joined the Liberals and part didn't. And then the bit that went on ended up having the SDP with a tick on the end of it. How you rebrand these. And by the way, one of the things, after the 1997 election, when the Conservative Party was in a lot of trouble, we ended up feeling that we could get the Sunday newspapers every week to cover the story of whether we were going to get a new logo, because everyone was so interested in that we could stop them writing anything else week after week. It used to be like a little competition. And in the end, we did change the logo, but it didn't really make very much difference unless you changed the underlying product.
Well, I've been wondering whether or not we shouldn't actually change the name of this little sequence we do from Finkelvich to the more dynamic-sounding Aerofink. with this kind of, I think it has a kind of connotation of speed of thinking and that kind of London rootsy side with think, you know, I think, etc. So I was going to suggest that. Or that, in the spirit of Aberdeen, that we all now work for Teatums UK, which would be really good. It would be very, very, very modern. We stick it on the masthead of the Time, not the Times. Who wants the Time? Teatums UK, which distinguishes us from the New York Times and the LA Times and the Times of India and so on. And then I was thinking about Aberdeen. You wouldn't have a problem with this at all if you're Polish, because Poles actually quite often can get through whole incredibly long names without any vowels in them, and so on. So they probably wonder what on earth the fuss is all about. It just thinks it's kind of very kind of simple thing. It's quite obvious how to say it.
Maybe that's what they're doing. They're hoping to break the Polish market. Right, before we do have a rebrand, I think we definitely need some sort of away day. The three of us need to go off somewhere with a flip chart and, brainstorm. At great expense, probably with lunch laid on as well. I think that's definitely what we need to do. I'm worried that we're going to have to... What is the name of your dog, Danny?
Aiden.
Very good. Well, I think that now needs to be added into Finkelvich. We'll try to... Yeah, all ideas suggested for that would be much appreciated. Nick says, the comedy timing of Cerberus barking in the background on Matt Jordy is up there with the very best. Well, thank you for that. I'm glad you're listening to the dog rather than me, Danny or David. That's Danny Finkelstein and David Aronovich there, and you can read them both in the Times every week. Just get yourself a Times subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/TimesRedBox. Up next, I speak to Jimmy Wales, founder of Wikipedia.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for my interview with Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia. How did Wikipedia start? Because obviously now it's this monster, which we'll come on to, in terms of the you know, the number of pages and the amount of information that's on it. But presumably at some point there was the very first page on Wikipedia. Did you write it? What was it about? How did it start?
Yeah, so back in 2001, I had a prior project called Newpedia, same goal, but very academic, very top-down. Didn't really work. That was getting to be frustrating, and I had heard about this software idea called Wiki, meaning a website anyone can edit. So I set up the first Wiki software, free software package I found online, and I typed Hello World and hit save, and that was the first words of Wikipedia, and that was back in January of 2001.
And then how did it grow? How quickly did it sort of take off to grow into what we know today?
Yeah, we had a fairly good sized community already who were trying to work on the Newpedia project, which is very hard to work with. And so we actually got more work done in the first 2 weeks than we had in the first 2 years. So we had about, a couple dozen articles fairly quickly. And then it just, from there, it just grew and grew and grew and grew and grew. And, you know, at one point, our traffic was doubling every couple of months. That was quite an intense time period. And then today, you know, we're seen by hundreds of millions of people every month. And we're, you know, part of the infrastructure of the world, really.
It is extraordinary how you're right. Part of the infrastructure of the world is a really good way of putting it. What is the etiquette of who, I know anyone can edit, but who can edit what? How much time do you spend? Do you still spend much time editing pages on there?
I spend some. I spend time talking to the community, really more than anything else. It's about editorial policies and behavioral policies and things like that is what I focus on. Actually, just yesterday, I'm from Alabama, and I found myself on a page of a list of songs about Alabama, and I went down in my hometown, Huntsville, Alabama, was listed, and there were about 7 songs, and I was skeptical. I went through the entire list. I kicked out 5 of them because they weren't about Huntsville, Alabama. They were about Huntsville, Texas, where the famous prison is, or they didn't exist or whatever. So I spent more time than I should have researching songs about Huntsville, Alabama. But you know, yeah, anybody can participate. We do have certain rules around behavior, mainly, and quality. You know, we want everything to be reliably sourced. Wikipedia is not a place to just come and spout your random opinions. If you want to do that, you can go on Twitter or whatever. we have a universal code of conduct. We expect people to be kind to each other and friendly and helpful and so on and so forth, which we kind of, you know, somewhat live up to and somewhat don't. I mean, we're human beings in a community, so but we really try hard to be a nice place on the internet.
And who spends their days editing on Wikipedia? Am I wrong for thinking it's a particularly geeky type of man?
It is. Yeah. It's quite geeky. We think the community's 80 to 85% men. We would like to change that. That's a big emphasis within the community. The community itself would like to change that. And, you know, that sort of diversity in the community is really important, not just to be politically correct, but just because people from different backgrounds have different information and knowledge. You know, if it's only computer geek men, you get a really fantastic article about the USB standard, but you don't get a really good article about other aspects of life that they don't really pay attention to.
And do you know the sort of the gender split on pages about people? You know, because I suppose the risk of it, if it's all a certain type of man writing, you know, creating pages and updating pages, do you basically end up with lots of male history, for example, rather than...
And that's actually something that we really focus a lot on, is really saying, look, you know, if you go back in history, so this is the way I always talk about it. If you go back in history and you want to write about chemists from the 18th century, it is going to be mostly men because, frankly, women were largely excluded from certain professions back in that time. And that's a historical tragedy that we can't actually fix. We could do our best to cover in a serious way those who were able to work in those fields at that time. Where we really focus on it, though, is in contemporary times. If we see that male scientists, male authors are getting more attention than female authors of similar achievement, well, we think that's a terrible thing. And so there are really concerted efforts to make sure that that doesn't happen, or if it has happened, that it's being corrected.
So is that a sort of active sort of policy that's pursued at Wikipedia? Is it people who work on Wikipedia will either take down some of those male pages or try to counterbalance it with pages about women in that field?
Less likely to take down, more likely to build up, I think would be empirically the way it works. And we have some fantastic groups in the community. There's a group called Women in Red that really focus on this issue of making sure that we're covering history in an even-handed and fair way and being inclusive and not just sort of being what geeky men know about.
Now, maybe it's a man or woman, I'm not sure, but somebody has set up a page about me in sort of the last 12 months. Now, I'm always thinking it's very bad etiquette. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Asma Mir from on Tom's Daily Breakfast was complaining this morning about it. There are mistakes on hers. There's nothing wrong with mine, but it's very bad etiquette for me to edit my own page. Is that right?
It's not considered ideal because it's very hard to be neutral about yourself. Also, you know, I don't know, a tabloid newspaper might notice you doing it and rake you over the coals for it, you know, that sort of thing. Best thing to do is to leave a comment on the talk page and, you know, just point out other sources or send an email. That way it can be handled with a little more discretion. It doesn't have to be a big public thing. And that gets handled. It's all handled by volunteer editors, but they'll take a look and sort out the problem, or try to.
So what's your, I'll bear that, I'm currently only a stub. I'm not even a full article, so I'm not going to worry too much. I don't want to draw people's attention necessarily to. How do you see what is your role? Because it is so massive now. What is your role? You can't be sort of all-seeing eye sort of edit, apart from, you know, songs about the town that you're from. But are you a sort of, because of the community, what's your role in the community? Are you sort of benign dictator, constitutional monarch? What's your role?
I would say really constitutional monarch in the sense of Elizabeth II. in other words, I'm better placed as long as I don't do anything too directly. But I just remind people of our values and what we stand for, and to help, you know, think through policy issues and things like that. But it is very much a community driven project, not a top down driven project. So if we think in the old structures of command and control, that wouldn't be my role. If we think of coaching and leadership in a different light, I hope I try to live up to that.
And how big is Wikipedia, Jimmy Wells, since you sort of set it up? How many pages are there? How many words? What is this? The full scale of this thing?
Yeah, well, we're in over 280 languages. That one's a fairly interesting number, although a lot of the those languages, the last 80 or so, are actually quite small projects, but they're beginning to grow in the languages of the developing world. There's over 5 million entries in English. We know that we see about 1.5 billion unique devices every month. So that doesn't necessarily mean 1.5 billion people, because, you know, probably most people in the developed world see Wikipedia at least once a month on their computer and on their phone and that sort of thing. But, you know, it's huge. I mean, it really is part of the world in a way that's kind of astonishing to think about. And what's unusual about us is we're a charity. So we're a nonprofit organization. I don't work at the Wikimedia Foundation. I'm a volunteer, like so many other people. And you know, it's completely unique in the tech landscape.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because if you look at all the other people who've set up, you know, tech businesses two decades ago, they've all now got squillions of pounds. They're launching rockets. They're sending themselves into space. They're all of that stuff. Do you have regrets that you didn't find a way of monetizing Wikipedia in the way that you, whether it's Twitter or Facebook or Amazon or Uber or whatever?
No, it's fantastic. I always say, in 500 years, people will remember Wikipedia fondly, and they won't even remember some of the other things that are out there. So I think what we're doing is of long-term importance. Also, not long ago, I mean, I know a lot of those folks you're talking about. I had a Zoom call with a billionaire friend, and he was sitting in his attic, which looked very much like my attic. And I'm like, it's the pandemic, you know, I've got a nice attic, the same as a billionaire. So
that's good. Yeah. Even a billionaire can't escape a lockdown. That's
right.
Apart from, I suppose, if they go into space. Well, I'll tell you what, in a sec, I want to move on and sort of talk about the role of Wikipedia in the world and fake news and all of that sort of stuff. So Jimmy Wells, stay there. We'll talk more after this.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Yeah, Matt Chorley joined by Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia. Jimmy, how, in a world where, you know, we worry about fake news and misinformation and all that sort of thing, and we know because of the size of it, as even you discovered, some songs about, what was it called, Huntsville? Is that where you're
Huntsville,
from?
Alabama.
Huntsville, Alabama. Turned out not to be songs from Huntsville. So how much fake news is there on Wikipedia?
I mean, I would say it's fairly minimal. I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about Wikipedia compared to social media is how much really thoughtful gatekeeping the community does. I mean, they can be very firm about pushing for reliable sources and things like that. So just to give a classic example, back when Donald Trump was first running for president, and this is when we first started really getting a lot of concern about the issue of fake news, there was a story that went viral that said that the Pope endorses Trump. And this was shared thousands and thousands of times. It's obviously completely fake. Something like that, you would never get that into Wikipedia. Like, the Wikipedia community would look at that and say, oh, that's a weird newspaper. I've never heard of that. And they know all the newspapers because they're doing this all the time. They would check and they say, well, look, if the Pope endorsed Trump, that would be the front page of every newspaper in the world, because popes don't tend to endorse presidential candidates, and this particular Pope seemed like a really nice guy and very unlikely to like Donald Trump. And so if that sort of thing just doesn't make it through the filters at Wikipedia, that doesn't mean there aren't any errors. And it doesn't mean that if there's broader errors that are made in society, you know, if we get facts wrong, even in quality sources, obviously Wikipedia can't sort of resist that. But in general, I think you can say in most of the cases, Wikipedia is going to be OK. We don't pretend that it's perfect.
Do you get, given, you know, we hear all the time about hostile states and you know, sort of malign forces of, you know, trying to peddle misinformation online, is that something that happens through Wikipedia too? It's one thing someone, you know, getting their facts wrong, getting their Huntsville songs muddled up, but people posting things on there with sort of malign intent.
It, you know, in terms of coordinated campaigns, sort of at a state actor level, we haven't seen anything like that. It would be quite hard to pull off because the community is quite a close-knit group and they do know each other and so on and so forth. And if you come in and you're pushing one agenda really hard, people will notice that. I can't say that no biased person has ever edited Wikipedia. Of course, people come in with an agenda all the time. But in general, our methodology, which is, you know, open, thoughtful discourse, really kind of serves to balance all that and to say, okay, look, you're coming in with this perspective. We can look at that and we can sort of see how would we incorporate that. But you wouldn't be able to come into Wikipedia on something like, you know, say the airliner that was shot down in the Ukraine, where you've got two very, very different competing narratives. You wouldn't be able to come in and just sort of wipe out what the New York Times has said with what a newspaper in Russia had said. You know, it's really, it would be very hard to do that.
And is that one of those things where sometimes people change people's Wikipedia pages as a joke just long enough for you know, to get the screen grab. But is it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. People should not do that. I disapprove.
Right. Well, we don't want to do that. And is it basically the case then that the people who are in the community are seeing those updates all the time, and so that's how someone catches it so quickly?
That's right. Yeah, there are people who are monitoring recent changes, so every change that's coming in. Also, people add pages to their own personal watch list if it's an area where they have some knowledge or interest or expertise. So they'll see it the next time they log in and that sort of thing. You know, as I say, it isn't a perfect system, but it tends to work pretty well. And we also have things the community can temporarily lock pages if somebody's coming in repeatedly and causing a problem. We can lock things more permanently if it's a really serious problem. And people get blocked from editing Wikipedia, you know, all the time. It's quite a normal thing to get banned from Wikipedia if you're not behaving properly.
We've just had a message in from William asking, how is Wikipedia funded? Every so often I get asked to contribute money. I always click through the no options. Do many people make contributions? What's the money spent on? It's a really interesting
Fantastic question. So the vast majority of the money that funds Wikipedia is exactly that. It's the small donations. That is more than 90% of our income. We have some major donors, and you know, major donor meaning like 10,000 and up. We have a little bit of corporate money, but it's the bulk of the corporate money is basically matching gifts, employers who are matching what the employees are giving. And occasionally we get philanthropic grants from foundations and things like that. But really the backbone of it is the small contributors. And we really like it that way. It means we have a certain kind of intellectual independence. It means we're reliant on the general public, not on, you know, sometimes people say to me, oh, why don't you just get Apple and Google and Facebook to pay for it? And I say, let's just think, is that really what you want, right? I think you really don't want us to be beholden to anyone. We're Wikipedia and we should be independent. And then what's the money spent on? Well, we try to run the Wikimedia Foundation in a very conservative fashion. So every year we bring in a little bit more money than we spend. So we, over the years, we build up our reserves. The money goes for a lot of, we support local chapters all around the world. So we've got a Wikimedia UK, for example, and they do sort of local meetups and events and sort of partnerships with galleries, libraries, and museums. We have the tech staff, so the people who are doing software development and the people who are keeping the website running on the air, so operations. We've got accounting, finance, legal, you know, all the sort of standard operations, communications people. It's pretty straightforward, really. I mean, considering how in some ways people think of Wikipedia as being quite radical, we're actually quite a kind of a normal nonprofit organization, really.
Do you occasionally get people beating a path to your door saying, you know, they want to buy it, but big tech billionaires, they can slap a load of adverts on it and make loads of money out of it?
Not in a long time, no. I think they're aware that's not really going to happen, so.
And in the sort of the interaction politically, do you get a lot of, you know, there's obviously a lot of debate about government conversations with Twitter and Facebook and their role in the sort of what goes on online. Do you have a lot of interaction with government?
We do. I mean, we try to sort of educate lawmakers about the internet, about what we're doing. You know, because we're so unique, we have a unique voice in the sense that, you know, on various issues like copyright, we you know, often copyright issues online are considered to be some kind of battle between Hollywood and Silicon Valley or the music industry in Silicon Valley. We come at from a completely different perspective. Like, we're a group of volunteers trying to write an encyclopedia, and we depend very much on a free and open internet. And so we do have a voice in those matters. And then we also have had cases in the past and in the present where Wikipedia gets blocked in various countries. So we were blocked in Turkey for quite some time, and we fought that all the way to the Supreme Court in Turkey and won. And so now we're unblocked in Turkey. And then I end up doing a lot of diplomatic missions. So I go meet with ministers in different places who are blocking us or thinking about blocking us to persuade them that that's a bad idea. So, you know, oftentimes we do get called on to offer a perspective on various things.
I wonder how the current British government compares on your sort of rankings of government's commitment to openness and truthfulness.
I mean, it's hard to say. They often say things that are completely nonsense, but that's not unique around the world. And so, you know, it's sometimes is difficult because they get enamored of a certain kind of concept. You know, like one of the examples that I could go on about is the UK government tends to say weird things about end-to-end encryption, which don't make any sense whatsoever. But they get this view in their heads that somehow end-to-end encryption is the enemy, even though it's literally one of the most important and powerful tools on the internet for everyone's security and safety. And it's very hard to get them because it's very easy to say, think of the children, and very hard to sort of move them past that. But in general, I think, you know, the UK is, you know, I'd say quite typical of Western governments. They're kind of okay.
Kind of okay, but that's not a ringing endorsement. In this week of all weeks, it's one they might take. What can society do? Because, you know, in a way, you've built the model for this, the idea of a community response to trying to get at what is true and what isn't. Do you think there's something going on in British society right now? There's a big debate about whether or not the Prime Minister tells the truth, and people can't really get a handle on it, and some people say it doesn't matter. As a society, are we giving up on truth? Is something that we need to worry about?
I mean, I don't think we're giving up on truth. I mean, I think what is interesting is that, you know, people are very passionate about knowing what's going on. They want to know the truth. Certainly, we've seen in the times of the pandemic, we've seen a rise in people turning to trusted sources of information. Largely, people say they trust, you know, the government medical websites, so the NHS and things like that, and that they don't trust other things. But of course, we know there's a segment of society who get far more attention than they probably deserve, who are sort of, you know, they think 5G causes COVID or whatever, those kind of crazy ideas. So we're not necessarily reaching everybody. We haven't reached some sort of pro-truth utopia. But I think if we really look at the broader trends, people do care about quality. They want good media. They want thoughtful dialogue and interaction. And a lot of the systems that we've built, you know, the social media ecosystem, aren't really serving that demand. They aren't really giving people what they really want. And I think people are dissatisfied with it. Now, how do you move beyond it? That's a whole other complicated topic. But
do you think ultimately it means more regulation of the internet? Is regulation of the internet doable, desirable?
Well, I mean, I think the question of regulation is a really, really difficult and complicated one. And certainly regulation around the truthfulness of what random people on the internet are saying is kind of a non-starter. It's not exactly clear what could be meant by that. And you see oftentimes people pushing for some kind of regulation of the internet aren't necessarily the people who are in favor of more truth on the internet. I mean, certainly Donald Trump was on a rampage to regulate big tech, but he clearly didn't have truth as his motive. So it's a minefield. And, you know, I think that where I would look at some interesting questions around regulation would be, you know, if we look at some of the monopolistic choke points, I think that's what's going to get a lot of attention. You know, there's been a really interesting debate in the tech community, or it's not so much a debate, but just a thing that's happened. A company, well-respected tech company, small tech company, has introduced a new email service called Hey.com. I'm not endorsing them or anything. I just know of this story. And, you know, Apple was insisting that they offer a way to pay through Apple, and Apple would take 30% of it, and they didn't want to do that, and it was a big battle. And it's a really interesting thing because Apple has a massive lock on the platform of the iPhone. They take a 30% cut of all kinds of stuff, and for small companies trying to get a foothold in that space and compete, for example, with the Apple email product, it's an open question. And that's the kind of area where I think if we're really concerned about big tech, it isn't about Section 230, which is about, you know, people's right to speak online and so on. It's really about that kind of economic issue.
And do you think that's something that the UK government should sort of get a handle on to look at breaking up those monopolies, yeah, Apple and so on?
Well, I mean, essentially, because breaking up is kind of the classic response. But for some of these things, it's kind of hard to figure, like, you know, how do you break up Facebook? It's like, you know, it's like, well, these people can't be friends with those people on one platform still. You know, they are somewhat universal. But I don't pretend to have any particular answers here. But I'm just saying, if you're concerned about excess power, you know, it's really important to be very, very thoughtful about which levers you're thinking about pulling.
Just finally, before I let you go, what's going to be your next? What's going to be the next issue that you're going to try and tackle? Which subject are you going to be fact checking on Wikipedia today?
I don't know. I don't sort of sit down and edit like an ordinary random person all that often, but we'll see. I might go back and make sure that nobody had any complaints about my edits I did yesterday. So just sort of make sure I did the right thing. So.
What's been the most wrong thing that somebody said about you on Wikipedia? Have you ever come across? Do people dare?
I mean, most
to
do wrong that? Is quite extreme, but there was one amusing thing that happened. So someone had vandalized Wikipedia, and they had inserted a sentence saying that in his spare time he enjoys playing chess with friends. Which sounds lovely, but it's, I would like to be that person, but I'm not that person. I don't play chess with my friends. But a magazine picked it up, and then it was printed in a magazine, and then somebody used that as a source. And I had to sort of go in and go, okay, here's when the magazine came out. Here's where it was in Wikipedia. Like, it's just not true. So it's that was an amusing situation.
Well, we've come to the end of this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Listen to my Times Radio show every Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. You can listen on DAB Radio on your smart speaker. Get the Times Radio app. You can also listen to the Red Box Podcast of the Times Radio app as well. And if you want to read about the stories that we've been talking about, then you need a Times subscription. To get that, go to times.radio/subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.